Like Angry Birds is Department of Fish and Wildlife. Smart Village is.
The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Everyone could find a chair.
We're busy.
Going to open a public hearing on House Bills 3029, 2352, and 2339. We'll go with House Bill 3029 first. And Zach, if you could read a summary of the bill.
House Bill 3029 prohibits the Department of Land Conservation Development from requiring an area within an urban growth boundary with population of 10,000 or less to have a transportation financing program.
And I think we have Representative Huffman here. If you could come up and tell us a little about the bill. I think it's your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman, State Rep for District 59, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson, parts of Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties. And I did want to go on the record stating that, yes, in fact, it is my bill. I do care passionately about it, and I'm not going to pretend that it's a small fix to the TPR. I don't think any fixes are necessarily small. It needs to be considered heavily, but I do think it's an excellent bill for rural Oregon, small communities. Based on the last census, and essentially what the bill does is increases the exemption on population that would be affected by the TPR, or the Transportation Planning Rule, from 2,500 to 10,000. And based on the last census data, 55 communities would be affected by my bill. I have no idea what we'll find out Friday under the new census data. I'm assuming that there are communities like possibly Prineville that would have been affected before, may have gone over that 10,000 population cap as stipulated in my bill. So that is something that, you know, we'd have to. If anybody on the committee is really curious about exactly which communities would be affected, and I did talk to Representative Schaffler, Happy Valley was also on that list earlier, and he thinks that they would have dropped off also. Any questions?
Questions for the representative? I just have one. Was there a underlying reason, a prompt for this bill that brings you with it here today?
Absolutely, and I appreciate you asking that question. And Mr. Nick Sneed, my city planner from Madras, is going to be testifying, I believe, right behind Mr. Doug Riggs, and has a very thorough testimony. I'm hoping the committee can. He drove through the blizzard to get here across the pass, and so I'm hoping the committee can give him at least 5 minutes because he has some very compelling testimony.
Thank you. Questions for the representative? See none. I know you have to get to education. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
We have a number of people signed up. I'll call up the first three, Doug Riggs, Nick Sneed, and Linda Ludwig. Is Linda here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs with the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We represent the nine cities of Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County, plus Maupin, which is in Wasco County. And we've been very involved in this issue since about 2007-2008. So we really want to thank you for holding the hearing today. The hearing is on Representative Huffman's bill, but I wanted to give some background on the general TPR, and I think Linda Ludwig will follow up after Nick's testimony as well. The TPR, I just learned from John Chandler, who's been around the building a lot longer than I have, that apparently TPR's initial introduction was back in 1991, so it's been here since before I was aware. TPR motored along until 2005 when DLCD and ODOT and OTC amended the transportation planning rule. It flew under the radar for most cities, which are required to implement the TPR. And there were several changes made during that time and the implementation of that rule that have really been problematic for cities. One of the key issues is that the amendment mandates that all projects necessitated by zone change applications not only be planned but also fully funded for the entire 20-year planning period. And this has meant that any city which proposes an economic development project that causes an impact on the state highway system, which in many rural and urban areas run right through the middle of the town, must demonstrate how it will fund all the costs necessary over that entire 20-year planning period to be able to upgrade the system to meet all those specifications. I won't go into all the details, and you certainly have my written testimony in front of me, but in our community, that's meant that in Redmond, for instance, on a brand-new Redmond truck reroute, there was a 10-acre piece of property right next to the reroute that was applied for a zone change from a light industrial to an industrial commercial zoning, was rejected because at the 20-year build-out period of time, it would cause an adverse impact on the state highway system. The state highway system was brand-new and nowhere near capacity in year one. Madras has a very good example of this, and Nick will talk a little bit about it. And then there's another problem in that the growth from outside the cities that's impacting a state highway system, whether that be from rural development, county development, destination resorts, et cetera, cause an impact on the system but provide no revenue to be able to deal with those upgrades. And so there really is a financing issue. If you'll flip over to the backside, I thought I'd give you a little history of where the legislative process has been. In 2008, we initially raised this during the supplemental session. We were told at the time by the agencies, quote, that TPR was not a problem, that communities were not experiencing any problems with the TPR, and that there was no need for amendment. 2008 was a short session. As a result of that, those comments to legislators, nothing was done. We came back in 2009, and this committee took a real leadership role in passing House Bill 3379, which directed the agencies to go and come back with recommendations on change, both to their agencies as well as to the legislature. The initial report back from the staff last August essentially recommended very little or no action. That was taken to the commission itself, and the commission heard testimony from 13 local governments, including Corvallis, Hillsborough, Madras, Bend, Tigard, Metro, etc. And all 13 of them had essentially the same message, which is the TPR as a planning tool does not work. It was too bureaucratic, too burdensome, and ended up standing in the way of common sense planned economic development projects throughout the state. So at that point, the commission directed the staff to go back to the drawing board and come back in October. They came back earlier this month, and they've recommended a long-term work group or study group that with a goal of coming back with some recommendations in December. In the legislative arena, we have three bills. One is House Bill 3029, which you have in front of you today, which would eliminate the TPR for communities under 10,000 people. In the Senate, there are two bills. There's Senate Bill 795, a bill by Senator Chris Telfer, which would entirely suspend the TPR for 5 years. And then there's Senate Bill 260, which is the bill that the Central Oregon Cities have had drafted, which is introduced by Senate Business Committee, Senator Beyer and Senator Starr, which has three elements. That allows for creative financing for projects. So it would allow cities to draw a line, much like urban renewal, around a brand new area, and then snag a portion of the income tax proceeds from those areas to be able to pay back bonds that would be used for upgrading the transportation system. It would also allow for targeted changes to the rule, and I can go into specifics if you'd like, but I won't at this point. And then the third thing that we're pushing for that we've talked to the DLCD about, and we think there's some support for, is a more broad approach to the TPR. At this point in time, if you have an impact on a particular section of a state highway, say at milepost one, then you have to come up with a way to impact the vehicle mobility standards and the through flow of traffic at that mile marker one. What we'd like to do is say that we ought to consider a longer, broader approach to that. So if you have from Lapine down to Madras, and for $10 million you can put an interchange here, but you can speed up for $1 million traffic through a different part of the section, the region, that the department ought to have the specific statutory authority to consider that as meeting the goals of the TPR. If the goal is to maintain the entire system as a whole, then we ought to have more creative ways to go about that. So that's the third element of Senate Bill 260. So in a nutshell, those would be our proposals. We think Senate Bill 260 is a great way to start. We really appreciate House Bill 3029 and would be supportive. We think that an effort that integrates elements of Senate Bill 260 into this bill, or an effort that starts out with Senate Bill 260 and gets it over here, either of those would be good alternatives. Bottom line, the TPR has hindered economic growth. It stood in the way of economic growth and jobs throughout the state. It doesn't work well for planners, as you'll hear from our planner next to us, and we certainly understand the importance of protecting the state highway system, but there needs to be some balance. So we appreciate the committee taking a look at that issue today.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. Mr. Sneed.
Thank you, co-chairs. I appreciate your time this afternoon. I want to speak real briefly about...
And your name.
I'm Nick Sneed, the Community Development Director from the City of Madras. I want to speak real briefly about why the TPR is such an issue in Madras. I've talked with a few of the committee members already about this, but in Madras, we have a 15-acre parcel in Madras that want to change its zone from a rangeland designation to a commercial designation. The value of the property was $5 million. This zone change would have impacted or created 4.8 more trips on the Highway 97 system. ODOT required a $10 million mitigation for that. So this property owner was required to take 1 mile of Highway 97, change it from an existing three-lane system to a five-lane system. It's a huge deal. And so this property was going to meet some significant economic development objectives for our city by providing addressing some of our commercial needs. It really is a big deal. I'm here to tell you that this isn't an urban, this isn't a rural, this isn't a small, this isn't a large city issue. This is everyone across the state. Mr. Riggs indicated in September at the LCDC hearing, we heard from 13 cities saying that this is an issue. For example, the city of Portland, they can't implement higher density mixed-use zoning in their downtown because of the TPR, because the streets are full. The streets are full, and they are full for a reason. That's because they have very robust transportation systems, the MAX line, the bus lines, things like that. These are urban settings. In rural areas, it's an issue as well. We're required to mitigate our impacts upon the state highway system, yet we're required to find some sort of balance. So, you know, a question was posed to me last week, do I support adding additional trips to a state highway system that my community is critically dependent upon? And the answer is no. It's any state highway system is critical to any community's economic development. So I'm not here to say that we just want to throw a bunch of trips on the system and get on with life. That's not what I'm saying. We need to make some amendments to the rule to balance economic development objectives of both the state and local government. And I think we can do that with some pretty straightforward amendments to the rule that, frankly, are doesn't remove holistic authority that Doug Riggs has mentioned that is proposed in other bills out there. I firmly believe it wouldn't add additional maintenance burden to the state highway, ODOT, and in doing so, we can make some nice changes to the TPR that in the near term, the next 3-4 years, we can address some economic development issues in each community so we can get out of this kind of economic downturn and facilitate some economic development. While in the long term, we can take a larger look at the TPR and say, hey, is this really a good policy for the state of Oregon and give it some necessary time. With that, I will stick around if you have any questions. I apologize, this is my first time coming over here, but I'd love to answer any of your questions about this. I represent most of Central Oregon on this issue. We spend a lot of time. I represent last week. We bring the brain trust in Central Oregon of about six cities regularly about a week on this issue, trying to resolve it, and we've done it for over 3 years, and we haven't cracked the nut yet. So I'd love to have a discussion answering your questions about it. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sneed, and we'll have some questions maybe in a moment. Ms. Ludwig.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs Benson, Reed, and members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. I first would like to thank Representative Huffman for bringing forward this bill. The TPR is the TPR needs help. I want you to hear that. It is a rule that is housed within LCDC's DLCD's 19 planning goals. It's within the transportation goal. And cities are supposed to balance all 19 goals. However, because of the way this rule has been interpreted both by ODOT and DLCD, we find ourselves unable to balance the goals, particularly in areas of economic development, which is one of the land use goals, and in terms of housing, the density issues. So we, over the course of the last several years, have been hearing fairly regularly from cities, and I think the count is close to 30 now in the state, about their concerns with the TPR and how it's played out for them. It's played out differently for different cities given a different circumstance and different location. And because of that, the League petitioned DLCD, LCDC this last fall to open the rule and look at some amendments. To that end, the commission is, there was a joint committee appointed with OTC members and LCDC members, and they're currently in the process of scoping out the rule and will make a recommendation to their respective commissions whether or not they will go into a rulemaking effort. I brought with you today a document that was floated at the last meeting. This is a menu of issues, and I brought it forward to you today to illustrate the complexity of the TPR, the concerns that we've heard and seen with it, and the required fixes for it. You have on the front page probably 30 different issues that cities have had with the TPR. Representative Huffman's bill would be number 4, exempting very small cities. While we like the bill, in order to fix the TPR for cities comprehensively and with a statewide approach, there is no one single bill that we've seen here introduced yet this legislative session that would do that. We don't know yet what the outcome of the rulemaking will be by DLCD, LCDC, and OTC, both of whom have fingers in this TPR pot. I guess what I want to bring forward to you today is that it's likely going to take a multifaceted approach, probably with legislation, maybe this session, maybe another session, probably with some changes in the rule. It's going to be complicated to get it right, but it's essential that we do get it right, particularly because of our economic straits right now and the need to incentivize and be able to permit new development that is knocking in some communities at the doors but can't move forward because of problems with the TPR.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? Vice President Smith.
Thanks. Thanks for testimony. You know, first time, Schmerz time is great. Question that you sort of said, hey, this is this bill would address sort of urban and rural areas, and I think I heard everything you said, but in my understanding, but I missed the urban piece. I understand the 10,000, you know, the population of 10,000 or less, but I missed the large population center advantage of the bill that you were mentioning.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Smith. The actual bills that's written right now wouldn't address the urban or the Portland issue.
Okay.
Because of the 10,000 threshold.
Okay.
But I think there's easy fixes to that to address the Portland kind of issue or experience that they've had.
Okay.
So, you know, this menu here that Linda introduced, there's a couple things on there that you could do right away that would address Portland's issues that wouldn't affect ODOT a whole lot. I mean, it would really streamline some things.
That's great. Well, one other question,
please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And it may not be the kind of thing we can pull out of our hat at this moment, and we can follow up with it or whatever, Doug, maybe. But if we have, so I've heard, but I just saw census information on the state and where people are moving to, where they're moving from. I've met with, folks, my own extended family made their way in the real estate business and have heard various things. And my impression has been less that there is overabundance of demand for too little supply of new housing stock. And it's more that there is housing stock and a lot of growth that in an economic time when there was a real boom and bustle around housing development and around demand for the purchase of it, and so that maybe we're getting our supply and demand backwards in the timing of this thing. I don't know if there's, feel free to offer thoughts or tell me where I'm stupid, which is probably a myriad of ways, and it may be something else we just continue to talk about.
Well, I think that's a good question, and it's fair, but I think we have to be respectful that, you know, between 2004 and 2006, when property values were extremely high, you could probably make it pencil a very expensive transportation mitigation, especially in our urban area where land values are much higher. But in a rural area, Madras, how is one property owner supposed to pay for a $10 million fix? Mm-hmm. Keeping in mind that, you know, according to 2009 PSU population numbers, 85% of all Oregon cities have populations less than 15,000 and are not located in the metro area. Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing from that question is, hey, if the economy changes, will this issue go away? No, I don't think it will, because a lot of the rural areas, you just don't see the land values out there that allow you to make a development pencil that you can just say, oh, yes, you need to pay for this $3, $4 million transportation mitigation.
Yeah,
way before any actual shovels put in the ground.
We don't need to prolong it, but my question is a little different.
Okay.
My question was, if we bend over backwards to provide for additional ability, which I appreciate the argument, I certainly appreciate the jobs argument, to shift state rules so that we can move forward on additional housing developments, it is what the economy demanding right now, additional housing developments, mm-hmm. or is what the economy is demanding right now is people to move into the recently built housing developments that my friends, including some Central Oregon friends of mine, including maybe somebody in this room, whose houses, you know, are underwater and have been for the last few years. I guess that was my question.
Mr. Gutierrez, Representative Smith, maybe I'll take a crack at that. I'm not sure within the scope of the TPR, with the housing issue, what we're talking about necessarily is a lot of additional housing developments.
Okay.
It's more simply being able to move forward with those developments at the density rates that would be currently zoned or currently designated in a city's comprehensive plan, mm-hmm. that an applicant would want to put on that piece of property, but because that property may be adjacent to a state facility which may be already at capacity, mm-hmm. they can't be approved for the density that's already within that comprehensive plan.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have two choices, and this is where we get into problems. They either develop at a lower density, and I've got examples of that go from 300 units down to 30, which mm-hmm. totally don't make sense in a city core. Or they move further out. They move out further away, which actually incites sprawl, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much looking at whether or not we do this that we'll be able to gain necessarily more housing developments. Mm-hmm. We've certainly got some that we could effectuate currently, if not for the restrictiveness and the location of those developments with statewide facilities and the TPR. Does that help?
It does help, and I don't want to monopolize the discussion. We can take it offline, talk about it more later.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and Representative Smith, I wanted to add a little bit. I think that's really, it's a good question, and it's important to point out that that's what we heard from our urban Portland area governments. I mean, I live in Tigard, and the Tigard mayor came down to the LCDC commission and testified that they were trying to increase density in apartment complex, retirement living complexes along 99W, which is very close to where I live, and they were not allowed to do so. So the whole Metro 2040 concept of more density in town centers has been made more difficult by the TPR. In rural Oregon, what we've seen most of the time has been an effort to develop commercial or industrial sites. In the case of Bend, has had a terrible time getting approval for improvements for economic development purposes at Juniper Ridge because they have to, according to TPR, fund a Cooley Road interchange, and that's been a long-term process. Beginning to see some movement from the agencies, especially ODOT on that, but it stood in the way of commercial industrial development in the rural areas and more housing development in town centers in the Portland area.
Okay.
So it was one of the big surprises that we had in the last 2 years is it wasn't just rural Oregon. It was rural and urban Oregon both expressing frustration with this rule.
Well, thanks for that. We can talk further.
Yeah. Further questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel, Erica Hagedorn, John Chandler, and Sean Gillian.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Erica Hagedorn with Public Affairs Council here today representing Deschutes County.
we'd like to express that we want to join our Central Oregon colleagues from the cities in supporting common sense, balanced changes to the TPR. Mr. Riggs specifically discussed a site in Redmond that's zoned light commercial industrial that the county has been approached to develop, but the TPR stopped the development of that site. So we want to see support for 3029, which doesn't necessarily impact the site, but other changes to the TPR that will get much-needed economic development off the ground in Central Oregon where we need the jobs.
Ms. Chandler.
Mr. Co-Chair, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of the bill. I'd like to point out, as mentioned obliquely by Mr. Riggs, I testified, one of only a few people that testified against the transportation planning rule when it was adopted in 1991, and my appendix blew out later that same day, and I've always been cranky about that. I don't hold it responsible precisely, but I think the inference is clearly there. I believe, and we have argued about the TPR ever since 1991. There's been adjustments made by DLCD and rules. There have been this body has tried over the years to make some changes to it. I don't believe there's a single bit of public policy in Oregon, urban growth boundaries, urban reserves, you name it, that has been more pernicious than the transportation planning rule. I don't say that lightly. I think it is a well-intentioned, badly written, and badly implemented piece of policy. This bill in front of you is a good start on what I believe ought to be taken up by this body, which is a thorough look at how we balance land use planning, transportation planning, the needs of our communities, the realities of budgets, the impact of transportation, of congestion on development, and so on and so forth. The TPR, I think, is clearly addressing an important connection. No one questions that there is a relationship between land use planning, urban development, transportation, infrastructure needs. But the way the TPR gets played out on the ground, as you've already heard, gets in the way of development that has already been planned for and is being accounted for in other areas such as urban growth boundary discussions, infrastructure decisions, and so forth. I commend the bill to you. I hope that we'll have other opportunities to discuss other approaches to TPR reform this session. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. We'll wait till Sean is.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of House Bill 3029. And I think you've heard a pretty good array of the issues that people are having with the TPR. And I would just point out, Representative Smith, it is about more than just housing stock. I mean, our members on the commercial side are really seeing true impacts in commercial, light industrial, and industrial projects and the impacts that the TPR has on projects not actually going forward. And I think it's interesting today that we'll have a variety of bills talking about economic development and how we can put Oregonians back to work. I think this is a good start in assisting with that, and I agree with Mr. Chandler's comments that there needs to be a larger discussion about how we tie land use with our transportation planning, but this particular rule is one that has stuck out for, like a sore thumb for quite a while for folks. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairs.
Questions?
Yeah, I guess
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the thing would be handy to talk about, and maybe it's here, maybe it's over beer later, I mean, you know, and I'm actually interested in it, is, and I use the example of housing, but I think, you know, I would have the same question about commercial, right? I mean, I see lots of vacant commercial property. And one of the reasons for my newish interest in retrofitting buildings is because I think, as a way to, you know, do job creation, is that, you know, I do worry that if we, well, I don't know if I worry. I have the question about what's the share of vacancy, how many vacant commercial, you know, what's the percentage, or what's a way to quantify or understand the amount of vacant commercial property? And that may not matter that much to the bill, but I'm at least curious about it.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Smith, I'd be happy to get back to you on some numbers on commercial properties.
Yep.
I think they vary from areas of the state.
Yep.
While we saw some encouraging signs in the Portland metropolitan area, our commercial associations did, I talked to our folks in Salem who said, no, actually, we're seeing the opposite turn. So I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Great.
And get you some numbers on commercial.
Great, thanks.
If I might, Mr. Chair, in reference to your question, Representative Smith, and the one who asked of the earlier panel, with regard to housing, I just want to clarify for the record that not all housing markets in Oregon are in oversupply right now. In fact, we have a crisis starting to develop in the sense that there's nothing in the development pipeline.
Yeah.
some markets are clearly in collapse and will continue that way. Others, without something happening pretty soon, when the market turns around, we'll start to see a housing shortage in those areas, believe it or not. We're starting to burn through the foreclosures. We're burning through the shadow inventory. It's not an imminent danger of seeing escalation, but we see it coming at us within the next year or two, unless we get, and frankly, it's a financing issue, which is a subject for another committee, another discussion, or perhaps those mirrors you mentioned, that'd be a good conversation. But to your point about retrofitting buildings, we've testified repeatedly in favor of programs to retrofit buildings. The problem that you have with the TPR, if you take a building, let's say, and you're going to retrofit it to do commercial on the bottom and residential up top and make it energy efficient, all the wonderful things that we might want to do with that structure, if you're in a TPR-affected area where the transportation system is already at capacity, as Ms. Ludwig mentioned.
And that's the point she was making.
You can't do it. That's the problem. It has nothing to do with supply or undersupply or oversupply. It has to do with the fact that things we want to do for other social and political and policy goals are impeded by this transportation goal.
Yeah, I get that.
But in answer to that question, I hope I didn't rule out beers at some point.
Well, I didn't invite you. I invited him. No, I'm down with you too, man. You're definitely welcome. Let's do it together.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think you guys are confusing a bill that's over in the Senate that's coming this way, the beer bill. So we'll get to that one a little later.
Need to leave, Mr. Chairman, apparently.
Further questions? I have one. So the situation in these smaller communities is almost a chicken and the egg situation, where we have an opportunity, let's say, for a large box store to come into a community, but there isn't the money to build the additional infrastructure to allow that to happen, so it simply doesn't. So the question is, for the three of you, do you think that problem, is the state better for the fact that we didn't build this facility because we knew we wouldn't be able to, apparently, meet the traffic that this planning exercise says is going to occur? That's my question, and is that focusing a little on the challenge that you folks are facing in trying to recraft this rule?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the state would not be better off in your hypothetical. Particularly with regard to smaller communities, it's not only a planning problem because of the complexity of the rule, it's also a money problem. One of the difficulties, I don't want to get into the inside baseball here, but one of the concerns I've had about the TPR for many years is that it assumes that roads are like pipes, that there's a point at which it is full and you can't put any more cars on it. With regard to water, sewer, other forms of infrastructure, there are physical limitations. With regard to transportation, that's not the case. Downtown Portland is congested precisely because it's downtown Portland, because people are going there to shop and to work and to trade. In a small community, when we take these artificial goals of transportation capacity and impose them on Klamath Falls, Bend, you name it, all of a sudden you've created an artificial barrier to what is a real problem of job creation, commercial opportunities, whatever they might be.
Sean? Just a slight follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Riggs made a great point about the possibility of creative financing for these projects, so it's not necessarily saying that a big box store is going to go there and there's no money at all to make the improvements to the road. It's the rigidity of the rule as it exists now that the money's not available up front, but if there were ways that they could work to make sure that those improvements were financed, they would greatly appreciate that, and I don't want to speak for the cities, but that's kind of what I picked up from them on that.
Good point. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And I think we have an opportunity to hear from LCDC, so Bob Rendy and Matt Kroll could come on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rendy. I'm legislative coordinator for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And with me today is Matt Kroll, our transportation planner. First of all, this has come up really fast for us, and I think to really do justice for you to understand some of the complexities that you've already been hinted at by some of the preceding speakers here, I think we would need more time and a chance to give you a more general transportation planning rule primer than we're prepared to do today. But I did want to address the concerns about that are raised by this particular bill. We came here today ready to talk about a bill that speaks about a provision of the transportation planning rule that so far I haven't heard anybody talk about. So, and I think we can quickly jump past that, but I just need to point out that at least as the bill is written and as we were prepared to talk about today, it doesn't really address the immediate provisions of what we call 060 of the transportation planning rule that has been the subject of the discussion. So that said, I think the other important thing that, as you also already heard, is that LCDC and the Transportation Commission have been in joint meetings, and that's imminent, another meeting in March and a meeting in April, to launch us on a work program to make amendments to the transportation planning rule. LCDC has had, on many occasions, just recently heard from a large number of interests, cities, stakeholders in the program about these issues. And I think the list that I believe what Ms. Ludwig was showing you is a list of options that our department had prepared as to ideas and options as to how to change these rules to respond to some of the concerns. So we are embarking on that. It is underway. That's an effort that we will be undertaking jointly with the Oregon Transportation Commission. There are major elements of this rule and this program that operate with ODOT, and because they involve the Oregon Highway Planning Highway Plan, mobility standards in that plan, and a lot of features that we jointly administer, it is not simply an LCDC rule to change. We've heard many of the concerns today. I can't respond to each of the individual ones. There's many, and I think it's fair to say it would be pretty long and complex for us to do that. So with that, I also have Matt Krall here today. He's our transportation planner. He can answer questions about a lot of the very detailed issues that you heard today. But all in all, I think the best way, if you really do want to move forward with legislation, to consider some changes to this complex rule, we would like to start off with a presentation to you about how this works and what we're embarking on.
I don't think there's any doubt about people wanting to move forward. I think you can scratch that concern off your list. We do want to move forward. Now, whether this bill is the vehicle or not, I couldn't say. But did you have something to add, Matt?
Nothing specific, no.
Questions for our panel? Yes, Representative White.
Thank you, Chair. Just looking at what they have here, I don't see how this would affect things tremendously. It looks like they're, 10,000, I would almost like to see the number up at 15 or 20,000. But I'm just, is there anything that jumps out at you? I look at this and it looks like it would help central or rural Oregon tremendously in some of these projects they're trying to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiedner, I think generally, again, what the bill asks is that those cities be exempt from determining transportation costs.
Transportation finance program.
Right. Okay. And that's, I think, not really what we were hearing from the speakers today. They were about a different provision. But right now, cities under 2,500 are exempt from those requirements. Cities up to 10,000 may request an exemption. I don't know that we've had very many or
very
any of
few and none recently,
but that's already allowed.
Ms. Krall, I need to have you state your name for the record. So that
Matt Krall, Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development.
So could you talk further about those requirements? The bill itself is talking about transportation financing planning. I think I heard from the speakers talking about a different provision of the rule. So, again, that's part of the confusion we have today.
I think, if I may follow up.
Please.
I think the thing we're running into is there's some Senate bills coming, too, that are kind of all linked together in the way we should address them. So it may be something where we need to sit down and look at all of them and sort things out as a committee once they get here.
I think that's the correct thought. Just a further questions from the panel or for the panel. There's a kind of a concern I have, and I suppose it's brought out by the document Doug Riggs gave us, where he points out that in 2008, the agencies, and I assume he's including in that, LCDC, rejected efforts and suggestions for reform and said that TPR was not a problem. HB 3379 was passed, directing the agencies to consider changes. And then that was in 09. We're now in 11. That seems like a long period of time. What has occurred since that indication from the legislature that that's something ought to happen? Can you give us the actual events that have occurred, not just the talk?
Mr. Chair, the legislation last time was directed at Oregon Transportation Commission to adopt rules. Perhaps Mr. Kroll can give you the more detail about the things they have doing, but that is part of the effort. We're still underway with that. And as for statements that were made that there's no problem, I can't address that. I certainly made no such statement, but I don't know how to respond to that concern.
But perhaps you could say, if you agree, is there a problem?
LCDC has agreed there's a problem. We have been working with interest about the procedure to fix that problem. We are embarking, I think, full scale on that effort. It is underway. And
maybe you could share with us what is the problem.
Well, you heard some of them today, but I think that would be, we have heard from interests a number of concerns about this. I'm not prepared to give you that list. In general, what you heard from the speakers is as projects come up and where the transportation plans of communities do not provide for the capacity that would be necessary, local governments then are under this rule required to do either amend that plan and do additional planning or other options are available. All of that is, I don't know, it's just there's so many kinds of those projects that we could talk about, each with their individual issues, that and I would be happy to give you more of that kind of testimony, but I can't in a general way say the problems are A, B, and C.
Would it be correct to say that, did you have something?
Well, I think there are two general categories of problems we're hearing, many within each of those, but the one category is the economic development concerns, and I think there essentially the idea we're hearing is this project may in fact cause some congestion, but that's okay with us because we want the economic development project enough that we're willing to put up with the congestion. So that's one category of problems that we're hearing about. The other category is the unintentional effect in downtown, commercial, mixed-use, pedestrian, urban areas where, in fact, the state goals are encouraging more development. And folks are saying this rule is having an unintentional consequence of making it harder to do that. So I think that's, broadly speaking, the two categories that we're hearing most of.
And is there a time frame within which you anticipate completing the effort?
We'd expect about a 6-month on the rulemaking that would be initiated in April, so that would put it in the fall.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. And with that, I've opened the hearing on all of the bills, so I think we'll now move on to, unless I have someone else signed up for 3029. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Riggs wants to be heard again.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, very briefly, I just wanted to add two issues to the last comments, and I think one of the big problems is the inflexibility of the rule, and I'll just give you one example. Corvallis came and testified that they had, to the DLCD hearing, and they testified that they had applied 23 times for zone changes or UGB expansion efforts since the time the TPR, in every single case where the TPR could be applied, they were rejected. So, you know, the rule is very inflexible. The second is really an issue not of do cities not care about congestion. We care very much about congestion because we have to live with it. The issue is, in oftentimes, it's timing. So if a development has a 15-year build-out or a 20-year build-out period, so you start with a 10-acre piece of property, you know it's not going to be full until you're 18. Under the current interpretation of the rule, the city has to guarantee with reasonable certainty that it can pay for all the improvements that have to be made in year 18 or 19 or 20 up front. And with a 4-year step process, as the chair well knows, you can't guarantee the state funding tomorrow or 2 years from now, let alone 20 years from now. So it really is a timing issue. In many cases, we have asked for flexibility to be able to say we have a plan that over a 15, 20-year period will allow us to improve the transportation infrastructure. But that hasn't been good enough to this point. And so that's one of the main issues that the cities are very concerned about. So.
Thank you. Yep. See no questions. Is there anyone else that wanted to be heard again on?
There was a question.
On 3029, if not, seeing none, close the public hearing on 3029 and open the public hearing on 2352. Zach, could you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 2352 requires that if a city reduces available prime industrial land within an urban growth boundary to replace land or mitigate impact so that development capacity to satisfy the need for prime industrial land is not reduced or compromised.
And we have a number of folks signed up. We'll start with Elena. Elena. How do you pronounce that last name?
Guinea.
Guinea.
And there are actually there are a few people here testifying in favor of the bill as well who need to leave around 2 o'clock. I'm wondering if they can come up as well.
And they are.
I'm looking at Tom Gallagher and Jeremy. You need to leave early as well.
Thank you,
Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here representing the 225,000 working men and women of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are supporting this bill. We brought this bill forward because we have a problem in Oregon. We have a problem with our industrial lands. We are quickly losing many of our industrial land reserves as that land is rezoned into commercial, residential, and other development. And sometimes that makes sense for communities. Other times, we're looking at large areas of prime industrial land, land that's hard to replace, that is moving on to other uses without any look at the effect that that ultimately has on our ability to bring new employers to the state and ultimately grow our economy with good manufacturing jobs. We brought this bill forward as a solution that allows property owners and local jurisdictions the flexibility to rezone that land, to find other land to replace it, but to ultimately maintain the control that they currently have over their land, but as a solution that also allows communities to take a closer look at their industrial land base and whether or not they have room to bring in more prime industrial land to replace that land that might be rezoned. The concept presented in the bill should be a familiar concept. We talk about mitigation within the bill, and we really are applying the same standard to prime industrial land that we have applied for years to our wetlands. We're saying that this is a valuable enough resource that if we are going to get rid of it, we need to be able to replace it with something similar elsewhere. And like I said, we've tried to allow flexibility within the bill of how that's done. This bill only applies to prime industrial land, not to all of our industrial lands. And I do want to point out that it was brought to my attention late yesterday that the word action to, or the phrase action to reduce land could be applied to, or could mean that when land was approved for development, they would have to replace that land. That was not our intention. I have not been able to get hold of DLCD about this yet, but if that is the case, we'd be happy to amend the bill to ensure that land only needs to be replaced if the amount of prime industrial land is reduced, not just if development on that land were approved.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you. Chair Benz and Co-Chair Benz and Co-Chair Reed and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Jeremy Rogers. I am the project director for the Oregon Business Council. More specifically, I'm the project manager for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative statewide effort to develop a strategy and set of initiatives to strengthen Oregon's economy. We work on that with several other business groups across the state, including Associated Oregon Industries, the Oregon Business Association, the Portland Business Alliance, several members of key boards and commissions in the state, as well as economic development groups and chambers across the state. This year, in developing that plan, we traveled across the state and met, had meetings with business leaders and local economic development and elected leaders in about 20 communities across Oregon, all the way up and down the coast, the I-5 corridor, the 97 corridor in eastern Oregon. We asked what were the impediments to economic growth, to high-wage job creation specifically. The goals of the plan are to create 25,000 new jobs over per year for the next 10 years, as well as get Oregon's per capita income above the national average. It's sitting currently at about 90% of the U.S. average. And we asked leaders what we could do to, what Oregon could do to reach those goals. In nearly every community we spoke with, the issue of industrial lands was at or near the top of the list. Having an inventory of competitive shovel-ready industrial sites is critical for attracting new industry and for keeping expanding industries from going elsewhere. There's a broad consensus that the state is lacking competitive sites due to a wide range of state, regional, and local issues, and also that the sites that we do have are at threat of being converted to other uses. We have developed a long list of strategies that we can employ to fix some of these problems, and one of those is the bill that you have in front of you today, which addresses the issue of conversion of prime industrial land to other uses. I'll keep my comments brief, but I just wanted to put this in context. Visionary leaders in Oregon in the 1970s created land use system and land use laws that protected our farm and forest land from conversion to other uses, and those at the time were the key economic drivers of the state's economy, and that was the main motivation for passing those laws. Today, those industries are still.
Chair, if you could back away from the microphone just a bit.
I'm sorry.
That far.
Today, those industries are still critical, very critical, huge parts of our ability to reach those goals I laid out earlier. But also, other industries are, including the high tech industries, clean tech industries, advanced manufacturing, food processing. Many key industries that have different land use requirements, and for Oregon to move forward in a way that we are able to reach the goals of getting our incomes up, of having more high-wage jobs, we have to kind of take a similar approach as we did with farm and forest land and really make the protection of industrial land a key part of our economic strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Portland Business Alliance. First thing I'd like to say is that it's truly a pleasure to be sitting up here side by side with the AFL-CIO and a jobs bill. I hope to do that many more times this session. This bill is a blunt hammer, and I think it's time that on land use we started looking at those kinds of issues. It's time we stopped talking about process and looking at results. We are losing industrial land inside of the urban growth boundaries, and we're not expanding our urban growth boundaries fast enough and quick enough to have an adequate supply of industrial land for us to compete across the country with businesses that are willing to invest and willing to move. This is another example of the rubber hitting the road here on all of the different strands of public policy we've been developing over the years, where these strands of public policy come into conflict. There are simply conflicting goods. We'd like to have a tight urban growth boundary. We would like to be very good planners and very good stewards of the property and land we have. But the one thing that gets squeezed out in all of this process is the politics around industrial land. There are just not enough significant spokespeople coming in front of this committee for industrial land. You've had housing debates, you've had debates for mental health shelters, you've had all kinds of debates, but this session is going to be a jobs and industrial land debate. What we're talking about in Portland is basically the working harbor, and it's historical economic industrial land that's existed inside of Oregon almost since the beginning of the state. We're talking about local good public policy jurisdictions that put environmental overlays on industrial land, that require vegetation growth on industrial land. And you talked about in this committee earlier this week about brownfields on these very industrial lands and how difficult it's going to be to clean up and put these industrial lands back into production. But these are the lands that already have all of the major transportation connections and all of the infrastructure investment that industry needs. They're on rivers, they're on railroads, they're close to the airport, and they're close to I-5. Portland is exporting in river traffic, is the hub for agriculture, forestry, and manufacturing products across the state. Many of the businesses and jobs in your areas move their products out through the Portland Harbor. And we are going to leave here at 2 o'clock and go upstairs to work on some bills on the Senate side that are broader than this. But this bill, I think, is a key and fundamental piece of the industrial land development. I'm sure there's going to be some people coming up here and explaining to you that in some jurisdictions this is impossible. There really is no comparable land for port land right on the Willamette River. And that's the point. There isn't. And when they start moving that land out of industrial land, when they start crowding in industrial, other development that forces out industrial land and put pressure on that land, you and the rest of the state are going to be left without a prime resource. So I'll stop there and say to you, we hope that you move this bill. We'll be back here a number of times on these issues. The industrial land and jobs bills, along with the economic problem we have in this state right now, I think are the major topics of this session.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The vernacular in our society right now is what keeps you up at night, and this is one thing that keeps me up at night, is I'm scared that we're becoming a service-based economy instead of manufacture-based. I am concerned, though, that we might be running around with fire extinguishers in times of flood. And let me just ask a couple questions on how to interpret this. First of all, the statute says replace the prime industrial land, here's the second, or to mitigate the impact of that action. How do you interpret mitigate the impact of the action?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Lindsay, this bill is a canary in the coal mine bill. There is going to be, and my friends in the back of the room, and LCDC 1000 friends, and on the business side, are going to be working over the next couple of months, crafting language much more carefully to address the kind of issues that you're talking about. Mitigation of land, let's say right now, in fact, in one of the bills in Portland, they allowed you to mitigate by paying fee into a fund and doing your vegetation mitigation somewhere else. I think that what we're not quite figured out yet is how we craft an industrial land bill that also protects those other issues that Portland has, for example, cleaning up the river, protecting the river, protecting recreation and fish in that river. We've had a hearing on fish contamination and so forth. So I'm taking a long way around saying that you've narrowed down on some pieces of the bill here, that if we were going to move this bill, or if this bill was the prime vehicle, we would be looking at the definition of prime industrial land that might not be correct. We would be looking at mitigation. I would be looking at this bill just exactly the opposite. I would be saying right now, you can't convert industrial land. Not that you don't mitigate it in the Portland area. You just plain can't convert it because there is no replacement for it. So your question was technical, and I don't think I quite answered it exactly.
Follow-up questions. I think you do, and that was going to be my second question, is what happens if you cannot? What is the consequence if you cannot, literally cannot do it? Is it just prohibited? That's number one. Well, go ahead and answer that, and I'll ask my...
Well, again, you're asking a very good question, because when they went around the state and asked for comments on this, people said, use the technique we've used in the past. Make them mitigate for wetlands, make them replace the land, make them do this. We are getting all sorts of comments on what are these identifiers, what is significant land, what are the alike characteristics and so forth, what's it got to do with flat land, how much slope in the land, how far from transportation, et cetera. So I think that As we work through the bills on the Senate and we come back to you, you'll either see this bill in this form or in a slightly different form that gets at precisely that. What lands need to be protected for how long? How do we protect the ownership of that land if it doesn't develop, because you don't want to tie up land forever? What do we do with patient landowners and so forth? You just open the door to an extremely broad set of issues that we're only beginning to, in 766 and 791 on the Senate side, begin to take a look at.
And then maybe my last question, if that's okay, and that is putting my layman's hat on, and that is, what do we tell the person that, let's say that a prime industrial land gets converted at the expense of someone that has commercial that has to be then converted to prime industrial? It seems like we might be rewarding one and punishing another. And where am I wrong or am I right?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Lindsay, that is such a good question. The answer to that is why I hate planning, because planning cannot take into consideration all of these aspects. Let me give you a very, and Representative Fredericks was in here talking about it. Some of these lands are underwater contaminated soil property, and the development on that land that would bear the cost of cleaning up that property may be something other than industrial. It may be a high-rise development, that the condos moving down Front Street, and the price, the value of those condo development can pay for a heavy level of environmental cleanup. What we're going to be working out in a work group, and I welcome all of you to join that was one that started last fall. Representative Gilliam, Representative Clem from the House started that work group. What we're going to be looking at is how do we deal with precisely those kinds of issues. Secondly, how do we deal with a landowner who may be able to use that land for some other very valuable purpose, but he sits in this prime industrial area? How long does he have to hold that land waiting for development? This bill doesn't touch on those issues. Now, those issues are in 766 and they're in 719. They tie together land use and economic development. And again, if you look at the people behind me in the back of this room, I think we have a skill to answer those questions. I think we have a skill to write and craft language that will deal with those questions. And I think we're going to do it in this committee and in Senator Byers' committee on the Senate side this session.
Mr. Chair,
please.
May I take a quick stab at those questions also specifically relating to the language in this bill?
Please.
Thank you. And Chair Bence, Representative Lindsay, I think when you ask the question about what we do if we can't replace the land directly with like land, that hit the nail on the head for why the phrase mitigate the impact is in this bill. I don't know specifically what mitigating the impact would be. I think that would be a rulemaking question for DLCD. That language is in the bill specifically because there are areas and there are circumstances where prime industrial land is so valuable and is so unique that it can't be directly replaced. And if the ability to create jobs on that land and use that land were inhibited for whatever reason, we would need to come up with another method to mitigate that impact, be it with job creation means elsewhere, even if it weren't designating prime industrial land, or some other way. And like I said, I think that that's a rulemaking question that we would have to bring DLCD in to further discuss.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question I was going to ask has in general terms an answer begun. I wanted to sort of betrays also my general ignorance about this process, but I'm curious in part because I had some folks ask me about this, and I'm certainly not qualified to answer it, what exactly the word action means in the bill, takes action. And so I understand, based on your answers since the time I sought recognition, that might be in the technical category that you're still working on, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on it.
That concern was brought up to me yesterday, and the concern that was expressed to me, I'm not sure if it was the same one that was brought up to you, is that take action could apply to things like approving permits to develop the land. Our intent was if you read the entire sentence, that it would take action to reduce the amount of land available. So things like rezoning, requirements placed on the land that would mean that less acreage of the land was developable for industrial uses and job creation activities, not things that would develop the land to use it for its industrial purpose.
Sure. I think I understand the intent, and so the concern that was expressed to me was just that it wasn't especially clear in that. So I imagine that's already flagged for you as something to keep working on. And I think the other ones have mostly been covered in terms of what happens if you can't find others. So I think that's it for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My first question was just I just wanted to hear from Ms. Guinea on the questions that we're hearing from, and I think I did. Is there anything else you wanted to add to the to some Representative Lindsay's questions?
Unless there's something I didn't cover in my answer before, I think I'm all right. Thank you, though.
Then the other question I had, and it was what we heard was helpful. And maybe we're getting sort of the crux of the matter with the last couple of questions, but the argument, so the need, I think probably all of us are sympathetic to, I can at least speak for myself. And the argument to which I'm also sympathetic is your argument that it doesn't freeze the location of prime industrial lands, rather freezes the amount. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that maybe there's, I could imagine, that might raise some questions. Who knows what we'll need 7 years from now, but I assume we'll always want to build things. And, you know, if we just have all the only people build things who live in China, that's probably not good news for any of us. The other challenge, though, that I see is in an area that has no available alternative prime industrial land, or is growing to the degree that at some point soon it won't, mm-hmm. then we get to the point there is no alternative. And so thinking about that, and I know we discussed possible ways, maybe your work group also is addressing that same question, and possible ways either through sunset or through having it a rebuttable presumption, but that sort of there might be ways to address that also. Feel free to offer comment. I want to say it for the record, and feel free to shoot those thoughts down or amplify them or offer others.
You know, I would guess that right now, and I don't want to say for sure because I am not from any of our cities, but I would guess that right now there is not a single area in this state that doesn't have some other available land.
Sure.
There's clearly more opportunity to move around our industrial land in some areas than others. I'm sympathetic to the fact that this does freeze in time the amount of industrial land we have. In the future, that might be something we want to reconsider. I think right now, though, that's part of our intent because we are losing specifically prime industrial land so quickly in some areas, and that's so important for our ability to redevelop our economy, get our state back on track, and hopefully, as my colleague to my left stated earlier, increase our average wage in the state that has been falling steadily for the past 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
As to what we would do when we don't have land that we can replace prime industrial land with, I think that that's a great argument to keep the prime industrial land that we have. If there are scenarios, though, where it makes more sense to convert that land to another use, I'm happy to consider ways to mitigate for that. I'm happy to look at amendments to the bill to do that. I think we'd need to have further discussions offline about it.
Great. Let's do that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions of this panel? Well, we'd like to keep you here for more questions, but we have 6 more people signed up and 2 more bills after this one, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Krieg, Randy Tucker, and Daniel Eisenweiss. And committee members, we have roughly 40 minutes left, so I would encourage short, succinct questions. And that's a hint to the 3 panel members. Who's going first?
So hold, Mr. Chair.
Chair Bentz, Chair Reed, members of the commission, committee, I'm Brian Krieg, representing Sheet Metal Workers Local 16 and the Sheet Metal Air Conditioning Contractors Association. We're in support of the bill in general and the concept behind it. We have quite a few shop facilities that are in urban areas. We also have manufacturing sites and a manufacturing base to our industry. And it's important for our businesses to be able to have long-term planning and stability. We need to have some certainty as to where we can continue to work, potentially expand, or if we're needing to move, that we can still be within the regional area. If a significant public need for a specific property exists, we need realistic options on relocation if that was to occur. And that includes having equivalent infrastructure and services. That's a really important element that was towards the bottom of the bill on that. I would point just to a very similar scenario that one of my manufacturers had. They are still in southeast Portland near the rail line. They're a manufacturer. They make equipment for the wine industry. They make tanker trucks for fish and wildlife, other types of groups. They need the flexibility of being near the rail lines and their facilities. We were looking at the first alignments for the Milwaukee Light Rail Line was going to cut directly through their manufacturing operation. Now, we were talked to by the TriMet type folks and others that, oh, we'll help you find another place for your facility. Well, quick look through that, found nothing that would really work for this company. Luckily, the alignment for that light rail line was moved a couple of blocks away, so we didn't have to go through a very, very difficult situation, and that company maybe perhaps even closing its doors. So this is a significant issue out there, and we really support the effort that is being made to find a solution.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Bentz, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. My testimony will be a little bit different having listened to the first panel, I think. I think the colloquy between Representative Lindsay and Mr. Gallagher kind of revealed that this bill is a starting point for a much broader conversation, which clearly it is. So let's speak a little bit less to the specifics of the bill than to the larger issue, if I may. But I mentioned a couple things with respect to the bill itself. We've been involved, Metro was involved, along with a lot of other stakeholders in the work group that Mr. Gallagher mentioned that began to meet during the interim that Representative Clem and Representative Gilliam convened, and a lot of issues were raised at that time, including the protection of our existing supply of industrial land. The Metro Council is responsible for providing a 20-year supply of industrial land for the region and has policies as well that are in place and have been recently been strengthened for protecting our existing supply of industrial land. We've got a designation under our Title IV called Regionally Significant Industrial Areas, which are where you cannot convert those lands to commercial development. There's limitations on the size and location of buildings for retail, commercial, and professional uses, big box stores, and that sort of thing. Recent changes prohibit siting schools and large places of assembly and parks on those lands, and prohibit breaking up parcels that are large, because the biggest shortfall in the region is large industrial parcels. In fact, right now, we have inside the urban growth boundary a 20-year supply of industrial land. What we don't have is a 20-year supply of large industrial lands, large parcels of industrial land. And the council last fall signaled its intent to bring in a few hundred acres of industrial land once we get through the urban and rural reserves process, which is the subject of the next bill that you'll be hearing, and I'll be back up here to talk about that. Another major point is that having land is one step. Mr. Gallagher, I think, used the term shovel-ready. The key is being able to provide the services that will actually make the land usable, and we have a major effort underway in our region, and we'll be talking to you about this over time, to develop the revenues and the resources to bring land online. That's a major challenge that we face in the region. As to the bill itself, the bill speaks to requiring a city to mitigate, and in our region, of course, cities are not the ones that have the responsibility for at least managing the urban growth boundary. To the extent that there's that's a part of the conversation, there's regional actions that would need to be taken. I do have a little bit of concern that the bill is short and simple to a fault, given the complexity of the issue that has been revealed by the earlier panel. But we'd certainly be willing to participate in a work group or conversation about how to address these larger problems. And Mr. Gallagher mentioned Senate Bill 766, which has a process in it, as introduced, for the identification of regionally significant industrial lands around the state, as the metro region has done, and for the protection of those lands. So I'm happy to continue that conversation with you.
Thank you.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. You have written testimony before you. I'll try to keep my remarks brief in the interest of time.
Thank you.
The City of Portland has long been interested in making sure that we protect our industrial lands for industrial use. In 1980, we were the first city in the nation to adopt industrial land sanctuaries to prevent conflicting uses in our industrial areas. More recently, we've been supportive of the strengthening of Metro's Title IV protections for industrial land that Mr. Tucker spoke of. So while we very much support the objective of House Bill 2352, it does raise a number of concerns for us. I think you've hit on many of the concerns, and that this is a very blunt and broadly written instrument that puts what boils down to an unworkable mandate on local governments. Certainly in the metro area, for a local jurisdiction, a city specifically, there is not the authority to move the urban growth boundary or take action on one's own. And if this proposal were to go into effect, cities still face federal and state planning mandates to balance competing values. So it adds a mandate for us without providing any additional flexibility or relief. I'll leave my comments at that unless you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? If we had more time, I'd have more questions, but I really appreciate your testimony. And with that, we're going to go to the next panels. So thank you very much. Linda Ludwig, Sean Jillians, and John? Is that John? John Chandler.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, co-chairs. I'll be painfully brief. We do support the concept here. I think you'll see a renewed emphasis on economic development from our association, the session, and the ripple effect that has throughout the entire real estate industry, and we look forward to working with this committee on any of these bills dealing with industrial lands.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Member of the Committee, John Chandler, Home Builders Association. As with Realtors, it may be a little unusual for us to show up on a bill like this. We fully support the concept. More jobs means more people who are able to buy houses. That's the connection. I think that you've heard some very interesting conversation. In the interest of time, I will limit my remarks to simply saying we'll be happy to work any way we can to move this important issue forward.
Thank you.
Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. You're going to be getting some written testimony from us. I think this bill, on reading it, frankly, you have a good gut response. But in terms of workability, it does not work for cities, and the League is opposing the bill at this point in time. Let me run through you a couple of the reasons why. We heard testimony from Mr. Gallagher about an ongoing work group over in the Senate side. It's my understanding that there are no city representatives in that work group, and I do point that as an important flag in terms of the practicability of both the bill that you see here and what may be coming forward from you to the Senate. So I think that's very, very important. In terms of this bill, the objectives are great. They're good. But in terms of the existing land use requirements that cities have to go through, we could not effectuate this bill in many regards. Cities and Metro, if they utilized a piece of land and had to replace it, they cannot expand the UGB if they would have to in order to replace it. That's a problem. Other cities would be stymied because without authorization to convert residential land to industrial land for replacement, we would not be able to achieve the outcomes of the bill. Our existing urban growth boundary for employment lands is a very difficult process to go through for cities. Let me call it to your attention, the city of Woodburn. I've been going through that for 11 years. They've had an investment so far to date of about $1.5 million. City of Donald, 5.5 years, $325,000, a lot of money for a small city of Donald. Bend, it's been nearly 6 years, $4 million investment. McMinnville, 11 years. These are the first two cities were employment lands only. The others have mixed employment and residential. But it is a problem for us and would be a problem with the bill given the way it is written. In terms of policy, the bill seems to require cities to maintain their existing supply into perpetuity. Many places that supply, existing supply, is not adequate, and we may not be able to do so. It doesn't take into account procedural problems such as cities that have voter-approved annexation requirements. Those cities may end up with the voters denying an annexation that could be required for replacement property to be able to put infrastructure in place. Infrastructure costs under this bill would balloon at a time then you know that city revenues that are an all-time low with little ability to continue to leverage more tools or capital to provide this replacement or new infrastructure. And lastly, let me mention real quickly, you heard a little bit about the TPR in the previous hearing with the previous bill. The transportation system, the planning rule would definitely have to be amended for cities to be able to accommodate these needs for replacement, given that most of these properties would run in the metro area along the I-5 corridor with close proximity to state transportation facilities. So there are many, many aspects of this bill that make it unworkable. We're more than happy to participate, and we certainly hope there will be some city representatives that can supply some technical expertise to the continued conversations in the building. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what started out sounding like a really good idea, out of a concern for good-paying jobs for Oregonians, is now sounding like we've got some technical issues that need to be dealt with. Can this particular solution even be implemented? You know, given that we may want to kind of go that direction or achieve that objective, how do we get there? So one of my questions, maybe for Ms. Ludwig, because you might have, if not statistics, a ballpark idea or something of this. This is focusing on replacement land. But when I think about when we have lost industrial land because it's been converted by a city to some other use, maybe it got used for commercial, let's say. How much of that kind of activity is going on? And why are we losing, if are we losing any prime industrial land because cities are deciding to use it for some other purpose?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Nathanson, I would be remiss to say that we have seen conversions, absolutely. We have seen conversions from industrial land to commercial land or even residential land. In terms of how much or percentage-wise does that make up a big share, I could not give you those statistics right now here. But the issue is it is complex. We typically see when we have a site that's loaded with infrastructure, and cities have made a tremendous investment in infrastructure on a site, there's a lot of pressure by the public to utilize that site and not hold on to it just for industrial use. So there are different aspects of what occurs sort of in this whole game plan here, this game board. Infrastructure needs and costs are huge, but once that site gets loaded up, there's a lot of pressure unless the good industrial applicant comes along fairly quickly.
Brief follow-up?
Please.
Mr. Chair, this is very interesting and useful information, and so I hope that there will be an opportunity for cities and other interested parties to participate in figuring out aspects of what an appropriate solution might be.
Thank you, Representative Nansen and Ms. Chandler.
Mr. Chair, very quickly, just in terms of context, absolutely there's a complicated issue. Representative Nansen, you've identified that there's a lot of very technical issues that have to be worked out. And since this committee is going to be hearing a lot of these kind of bills, it might help you to keep in mind that we started out Oregon land use planning back in the 70s to protect our two key industries at that point, ag and timber. And we have 35 years' worth of policy and law and litigation and whatnot that has built from that premise. Now with these bills and talking about employment lands, Representative Lindsay's mentioned manufacturing, to try to shift focus not away from ag and timber but as an adjunct to ag and timber industries, it's going to require a similar level of effort. And this is a good bill, but it's quite simplistic in its approach, which doesn't mean it's a bad approach. It means simply that it's going to be part of a lot of discussion for this committee going forward.
Well, I think it prompts the conversation nicely. And as I understand it, the conversation is continuing in work groups. Is that correct, the Senate side? Did I hear that earlier?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So there is conversation going on. And if someone wants to enjoy participation in that, who should they talk to?
My goodness, look at the time. Mr. Chair, I've not been organizing them. The one this afternoon that Mr. Gallagher mentioned was convened by Senator Beyer. But I think this committee can certainly and probably ought not to tell you how to run your operation, certainly might want to think about setting up some conversations over here, because you're going to have different bills in this committee than what the Senate has. And at some point, obviously, those are going to have to be melded into either a bill or a series of bills and involving the technical experts, because this is not easy to do for all the reasons you've heard and many that we haven't mentioned yet today.
Thank you. I didn't mean to volunteer you for that, but you
I do appreciate that.
Well, thank you for that. And seeing no further questions, thank you very much, panel. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2352 and open the first public hearing on House Bill 2339. Zach, could you tell us what that bill is about?
House Bill 2339 requires a metropolitan service district, when including land within an urban growth boundary, to use at least 50% of the land designated urban reserve before using land of lower priority than urban reserve land.
And the first three people I have signed up are Jack Isselman, Sean Cleave, and Patrick
Kapper.
Send all these folks to calligraphy classes. There's been a request, by the way, that everyone submit both hard and soft copies of their documents. Is that a requirement now, so that we have folks that it is? I'll just make a note of it that we would sure appreciate it, so that folks can do that. And is there some mechanism, Representative Lindsay, that you should recommend they follow?
Yeah, thank you. So my request was that I know that some documents I receive electronically, and I have a hard time tracking all this paper, and it would just help if we got both, or at least had the option of electronic or soft. That would help keeping track of my notes. And I think that they have the option of, just as they turn it into the administrator, they can also email it to the administrator in advance, correct?
Zach? Yeah, if you can email me testimony, at least try to get it 24 hours in advance. We'll get it electronically to the members who request to go paperless.
Or they can follow up with it afterwards if it's...
Yes, sir.
Thank you for that. Jack, why don't you go first?
Chair Bentz, members of the committee, actually, I had planned to testify as part of a panel opposing the bill. The proponents, the committee might want to hear from the proponents first.
Thank you for that, Mr. Isselman, and we will delay your testimony until we hear from Sean and Patrick.
Co-chairs Reed and Bentz, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I represent the Farm Bureau on land use issues. The Farm Bureau supports House Bill 2339, and this is a kind of obscure but important piece that has been discussed in prior sessions. It dates back to 2007, when Senate Bill 1011 was passed, with the intent that Metro would have the ability to designate both rural and urban reserves. Farm Bureau is neutral on that bill, but the Oregon Association of Nurseries supported it, with the understanding that there would be a discussion that would reserve large blocks of agricultural land as well as rural areas for future UGB expansions, to in an effort to provide stability and consistent growth pattern for cities, but also to protect into perpetuity, from some perspective, high-value ag lands. We're talking about a 40 to 50-year timeline. Farm Bureau sat on a steering committee that was organized by Metro, and one of the things that came out of this process was an unintended consequence, which was the utilization of lands that were not designated either rural or urban through the process as being de facto urban zones. And three counties, multiple cities, and Metro both participated in this. We're actually on the verge of agreeing to the final map, which the last county that has yet to sign an IGA with Metro is Washington County. We're pretty close on the process, but from our perspective, keeping consistent with the original bill from 2007, we're asking, and from our perspective, very modestly, some control over those non-designated lands so that prior to being brought in to as new urban reserves, that they would be required, the cities with urban reserves would be required to utilize 50%, just 50% of their 50-year UGB expansion area. That's what the bill does, and with that, I will turn it over to everybody else on the dais or answer any questions that the committee might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean, for keeping that to the point.
Please. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Capper with the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2339, and I will keep my comments brief. The nursery and greenhouse industry is uniquely situated to speak to the pressures of urbanization and the role of agriculture, as my members are both rural and urban. The OAN continues to believe that providing reasoned places to grow reduces the pressure to urbanize high-producing agricultural land. Agriculture is not a default place to urbanize, but is rather an economic engine that is a viable and sustainable industry. The nursery industry in particular is affected by decisions of urbanization since we bridge the urban and rural divide. Our top producing counties are Marion, Clackamas, Washington, Yamhill, and Multnomah. OAN believes that the law as it stands currently does not currently protect against the eventual march of urbanizing agricultural land. We believe that this legislation is another tool towards addressing our concerns. OAN encourages your support of this bill. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And with that, why don't, if Sean and Patrick don't mind, I'm going to invite up Randy Tucker and is it Jan?
Jim.
And actually, if you know, before I let you go, are there questions for these two? Interesting bill, and we'll see what the opponents have to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Losing it.
Yeah, you go first.
Mr. Co-Chair Bentz, Mr. Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, let me get the microphone over here. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. What I'm distributing to you today is not testimony. It is material that has just been released as of yesterday afternoon, or at least two of the pages, the first two. It's a email from our Council President, Tom Hughes, and the Chair of the Washington County Commission, Andy Dyke, about the tentative, or at least the proposed, agreement between Metro and Washington County on urban and rural reserves, and then the first page is the email, the second page is the map that's proposed, and the third and fourth pages are the maps that have been previously approved and approved by LCDC of Clackamas and Washington County's urban reserves. So that's background information for you. Basically, we are
inside the two-minute warning, if I could, I don't usually use football metaphors, but I will. We're inside the two-minute warning of essentially a four-year process since the passage of Senate Bill 1011 in 2007, and the bill before you today would, at least as drafted, would significantly change the rules at this late date. There was legislation last session in 2010 and in 2009 that Mr. Cleave referred to and described accurately, but this bill does something different than what that legislation did. The legislation in 2009 and 10 said that you may not designate any more, we may not designate any more urban reserves until we've used up half the urban reserves we're designating now. And Metro was neutral on that bill. If that is the bill that the proponents intend to advance, we would actually, given subsequent events, we would need a small tweak to it, but we'd be neutral again. The bill before you, however, says that no land may be brought into the urban growth boundary except for urban reserve until you've used up half the urban reserve. That goes to the question of undesignated lands that Mr. Cleave raised, and I respectfully differ with his interpretation that the notion that land that would not be either urban or rural reserve is an unintended consequence or was never contemplated when the bill was when the legislation in 2007 was passed that authorized us to go down this merry road of mano a mano negotiations for 4 years. So there is always going to be some land, I think, that doesn't qualify as either urban or rural reserve under the legislation that was passed in 2007. And there is actually not that much of it on certain parts of the map, as you can see. It's the white areas. But the notion that that's somehow a surprise, I would disagree with. So we have concerns about the bill as drafted. It essentially says that all of the undesignated land becomes rural reserve, which is off limits to UGB expansion, no matter what land need arises in the future that may not be possible to be satisfied with the urban reserves until half the urban reserves have been used up. And that's not part of the original agreement, and it's not part of the rules that everybody was working from when the negotiations took place that were very difficult negotiations over the last few years. So that may be a little bit mangled testimony, but I hope it's understandable, and if not, please, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Just to sum up, we would be neutral with a small change on the original bill from the last couple of sessions. We would oppose this bill that's before you today. And so how's that for incomprehensible?
Very well done. Perfectly incomprehensible. Who's next? Jack.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, for the record, Jack Esselman, on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. I'll be very brief because my voice is failing me. We oppose the bill. We're emerging, as Randy said, basically from what could best be called, or what might be called, maybe not best called, but what might be called a four-year cage match on land use planning. And we would have made substantially different agreements if the provisions of this bill were in effect. It was not part of the ground rules for the negotiation that took place over the last 4 years. We believe it's manifestly unfair to come in and change the rules here at the end, and we recommend you don't do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, for the record, Jim McCauley representing Washington County. I, too, will make comments very brief, but will echo support for the comments made by both Randy and Jack up here. Although just slightly differing from Randy's, the Washington County also would oppose those previous bills that were introduced both in 2010 as well as 2011 or 09 session. This has been an exhaustive process, 4 years. I don't even know if anybody can tally the amount of hours that staff has put into this as well as the public in this process in terms of expectations and where we've been. The county, Washington County, has been really the last element of this to close the deal. It's been very complex. It's been a cage match at times with the conversations and the differing maps and tweaking this and that. And we're incredibly sensitive at this point in time with not even getting to a a stage in this process where we've got a completed plan and we've had an opportunity to implement it. This may very well be an issue to deal with in the future, but now is certainly not the right time. Maybe it deserves some reconsideration 5 or 10 years down the road, but we would at least want to have the opportunity to implement something that we've been working on for 4 years. And just as a caveat, I was in a different position at the time of this legislation in 07. I was working for Portland Metro Home Builder Association, and we were part of the discussion group that originally put together and crafted this legislation. And it's amazing over that period of time, a job change now with Washington County, and having been through this process, that we're still yet to complete something that we started a number of years ago, and we'd just like to have that opportunity to finish it. So we respectfully hope that you will oppose this legislation.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank
we have two
Chair.
People left to testify, Sean Jillians and I think it's John Chandler again, but it could be John something else.
He can't write.
And you each have about a minute or a little less. I'm sorry for that. But please.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you. Members of the committee, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Bad bill shouldn't pass. No, honestly, it has been a four-year process that we've been actively involved in at both the state and local level. The only point I would make is when we were back here in 2010, I think Mr. Tucker used a different analogy, but we were within the final frame of this being done, and clearly we're not still. It still has a public process to go through, and we feel it is unfair to change the rules in the middle of the game, albeit a very long one.
Thank you. Sean.
Mr. Chair, member John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, we don't think much of the bill either. We would recommend you not fiddle with it. We believe, with all due respect to our colleagues at the Farm Bureau and the Nursery Association, that they're borrowing trouble. The process hasn't even been finished the first round yet, much less the appeals for the first round, and it seems to us that it would be best to let the process play out the way the legislature designed it and LCDC and their metro area has been implementing it, and then see if there's things that need to be tweaked. But to do so now is premature, and we would not support them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Questions for our last two panelists? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. And with that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2339 and opening a work session on House Bill 2339. Zach, can you read? I'm sorry, 2192. Work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 2192 allows use of universal service fund monies for determining availability of broadband services within the state.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beyer has moved the House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection?
I have discussion. So, can someone just clarify a little bit? I've reviewed it, but and I think I was missing. I was out of here last Friday. So if you can give a little review, that'd be helpful.
Yes. I think we can have Mr.
And I have read, but I just need a quick little briefer here.
Yes, Rant, if you could give us a brief little summary, that would be... Actually, you can take your time. You have 3 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. And very briefly, in 2009, the Public Utility Commission of Oregon approached the incumbent telephone companies, which I represent, to... inquire if we would object to using universal service fund monies to map the availability of broadband in Oregon. We, after thinking about it, we agreed that that was a good idea. The language that we all agreed to restricted it just to broadband mapping, and the language that was actually adopted was far broader than that. We all agreed during the interim to work together to bring a finer point to it, and that's what this bill does. It restricts it to mapping the availability of broadband in Oregon, nothing else. So there's no substantive change. It's just restricting it a little bit.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, is there anybody that testified in opposition or?
You know, I don't think there was.
That's correct.
I think there were some questions from Representative Nathanson, but they were not. She seemed to be okay with the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Further discussion? Is there objection to this bill? Seeing none, the bill is passed through the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Sure.
and I need a carrier.
Okay.
How about Sean?
We have a carrier in the form of Representative Smith. Anything further, Zach?
Yes, sir.
Please adjourn.